Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with family members who for months or years have been trying to help those who are dealing with serious mental illness. This coming to the fore in the case of Dodger outfielder Andrew Tolles, who was found sleeping behind the Key West airport a couple of weeks ago, and his story told in a USA Today article about the tremendous mental health issues that he has been dealing with, according to his sister, both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And efforts by the family to try and help, to try and intervene and get him the medical care that he needs. We're going to talk with listeners who've been in similar circumstances and just some of the ways that you've tried either successfully or with great frustration to try and intervene and help a family member who's in crisis. That's later this hour on Air Talk. But we begin today with a letter published yesterday in Harper's, the liberal publication that has, in this case, published a letter signed by more than 150 prominent artists, academics, writers, intellectuals. And I'm just going to excerpt a bit of what is in this letter, which has generated a tremendous amount of response. The letter reads, "Our cultural institutions are facing a moment of trial. Powerful protests for racial and social justice are leading to overdue demands for police reform, along with wider calls for greater equality and inclusion across our society, not least in higher education, journalism, philanthropy, and the arts. But this needed reckoning has also intensified a new set of moral attitudes and political commitments that tend to weaken our norms of open debate and toleration of differences in favor of ideological conformity. As we applaud the first development, we also raise our voices against the second. The forces of illiberalism are gaining strength throughout the world and have a powerful ally in Donald Trump, who represents a real threat to democracy. But resistance must not be allowed to harden into its own brand of dogma or coercion, which right-wing demagogues are already exploiting. The democratic inclusion we want can be achieved only if we speak out against the intolerant climate that has set in on all sides. The free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. While we have come to expect this on the radical right, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture. An intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a blinding moral certainty. We uphold the value of robust and even caustic counter-speech from all quarters." The letter goes on in a very similar vein, and among the prominent signatories are Martin Amis, Margaret Atwood, Wynton Marsalis, David Brooks, Noam Chomsky, Megan Daum, David Frum, Francis Fukuyama, Todd Gitlin, Malcolm Gladwell, Steven Pinker, Jonathan Rauch, J.K. Rowling, Salman Rushdie, Gloria Steinem, Nadine Strossen, Bill T. Jones, Randall Kennedy, Dahlia Lithwick, Randy Weingarten, and Fareed Zakaria. Those are just a few of the names of the 150-plus who signed the letter. Now, there's been criticism of the letter, and two or three people who have rescinded their signature just hours after this was posted. And we've reached out to various critics of the letter, as well as signatories who have revoked their signatures, but none have been available to join us during our conversation. But with us is one of those who signed, president of the American Civil Liberties Union from 1991 to 2008, and professor emeritus at New York Law School, Nadine Strossen, who's been with us in the past on Air Talk. She's author of Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. Professor Strossen, so good to have you with us again today on Air Talk.
Larry, please call me Nadine, and I'm delighted to be back. And thank you for that very eloquent reading of the letter, which I continue to support enthusiastically.
Nadine, let's talk about your reasons why. What are some of the specific incidents representative of so-called cancel culture or shutting down of debate that have concerned you?
There are so many examples, it's almost hard to know where to start. But I will start close to my home in New York. The New York Times and the New York Review of Books, both of which have recently either forced out or prompted the so-called retirement of top editors because of disagreement about editorial choices they had made to publish speakers or ideas that were seen as being questionable, subject to challenge.
And this is particularly sensitive in the time where we're having a wide range of debates about policing, about historic, deeply entrenched racism, and how it manifests in the world today. And I think one of the concerns that's been raised about this is this letter in some way a retreat from, you know, wide-ranging efforts to try and redress these wrongs?
Absolutely not. I tell you, Larry, that the ACLU has been crusading on issues of police reform and police discrimination and disproportionate violence, and including killings against African-American men in particular, since the 1980s, when we were a voice in the wilderness. The Democratic Party wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. The Black Caucus in Congress wouldn't touch it. Everybody was against crime, right? And so for us, this has been just a wonderful sea change to see this galvanizing and broad public support and commitment. I could not be more thrilled and more committed to making sure that it is not just rhetoric, that this does translate into meaningful reform. And I absolutely believe, based on my decades of activism, that if we do not have a robust open forum for debate and criticism and analysis and challenge and questioning, there is going to be an enormous backlash against the proposed reforms. And in fact, we won't have reforms that are as effective, because I really do believe that old credo by John Stuart Mill, that one of the virtues of engaging in debate is that we might actually improve upon what our own ideas were initially.
Is there, though, a successful effort to shut that down? I mean, in this program, in the weeks since the series of protests around the country, we've debated the motto, defund the police. What does that really mean? If you're going to cut police department budgets, then where are you going to get social workers to take the place of responding to 911 calls? Are there the people trained to do it? Can you recruit the people to do it? Will they feel safe going out into the community responding? We've debated all of these, you know, specific policy issues. Is that really, are there really successful efforts to shut down those important policy discussions?
Apparently there are. And as I said to your producer, I've been so overwhelmed with, you know, calls and interviews that I haven't had time to do my own independent research. And I do think that in this culture, it really behooves all of us not to believe something just because we see it or read it. But I have read what seem like facially plausible accounts that by raising those very same kinds of questions, various people have, in fact, been punished and silenced, ranging from students who had been accepted to various colleges to begin in the fall semester, have had their acceptances rescinded, because to even question the concept of completely defunding the police has been attacked on some campuses as racist. I have read accounts of journalists who have lost their positions because of raising questions about should we look at the disproportionate impact that street crime, other than by police themselves, have against the Black community, and that has been attacked as racist. And unfortunately, given the other widely publicized and documented cancellations, I think it is all too plausible. But hats off to you, Larry. That is exactly the kind of debate that we are advocating for, and that I think ultimately will result in exactly the kinds of reforms, you know, better informed and structured reforms than an absence of that kind of debate would yield.
We're talking with the former president of the ACLU from 1991 to 2008, Nadine Strossen, with us, author of Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship, Professor Emeritus, New York Law School, with us. I'd like to hear your thoughts. If you have read this letter published by Harper's, it was released yesterday. We have a link to the full letter on the Air Talk page at kpcc.org, and I'll share some more excerpts of it. But I'd like to hear your thoughts about it. 150-some individuals who have signed this, saying that it's important we not shut down conversation and critique on multiple sides, dealing with issues involving what can be considered very sensitive subject areas. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. It's sort of shorthand been described as a letter against the concept of what's called cancel culture, the idea that if someone says something that some individuals deem as offensive, that somehow they should be pushed off of whatever their position is that allows them to speak on these topics. 866-893-KPECC. The letter closes with this paragraph. This stifling atmosphere will ultimately harm the most vital causes of our time. The restriction of debate, whether by a repressive government or an intolerant society, invariably hurts those who lack power and makes everyone less capable of democratic participation. The way to defeat bad ideas is by exposure, argument, and persuasion, not by trying to silence or wish them away. We refuse any false choice between justice and freedom, which cannot exist without each other. As writers, we need a culture that leaves us room for experimentation, risk-taking, and even mistakes. We need to preserve the possibility of good faith disagreement without dire professional consequences. If we won't defend the very thing on which our work depends, we shouldn't expect the public or the state to defend it for us. That's the letter published in Harper's, signed by more than 150 individuals, including our guest, Nadine Strossen, 866-893-KPECC. One of the critiques of the letter, Nadine, has been that it overestimates the power of cancel culture and that it calls cancel culture what in many cases is legitimate pushback or deserved consequences for people who say things that some consider deeply offensive. So your response to that critique?
That is an extremely important and delicate, nuanced point, Larry, because after all, in my recent book, which you kindly referred to, I do advocate robust counter speech, to use the term that lawyers often use, rather than censoring hateful or hated ideas. We should respond to them with more speech. And so there is absolutely no doubt that very strong criticism, which can have a hurtful impact, is part of the give and take that we're talking about. So it is a difficult issue at what point you cross the line to a disproportionate response that results in somebody losing their livelihood, losing their professional position, being driven away from a university into which they had been admitted. And it is a matter of judgment, but I think there is a strong distinction in a lot of the cancel culture kinds of communications and even strong criticism. The strong criticism engages with ideas, with evidence, with analysis, with reason, whereas the cancel culture relies much more on so-called identity politics, conclusory attacks, dismissing ideas as, oh, you are just some kind of an ist or some kind of an ob. In other words, saying it's not even legitimate to engage in the search for evidence and reasoning because your position is, we're just going to deem it inherently unacceptable, inconsistent with our view of what constitutes racism, sexism, and so forth.
This critique, I'm not sure I fully understand it, but I'm going to share it. And it's the idea that the people that signed the critique have large platforms. So I guess the critique is that they shouldn't criticize this because they don't have to worry, I guess, or that they shouldn't be concerned with other people that they believe are shut down. I'm sorry, I'm doing a lame job of describing this critique. Maybe you can flesh it out.
A couple of the people who signed this letter definitely had very prominent platforms, and they were pushed off those platforms because of a single, what was seen as being misstep, even in a long distinguished career. So Ian Brundy, who was the editor-in-chief of the New York Review of Books, was pushed out. He was the editor-in-chief of the New York Review of Books, very powerful position, but because of publishing a particular piece in a long, long career, was seen as that was unforgivable. Likewise, Ron Sullivan, a distinguished longtime civil rights lawyer, law professor at Harvard Law School, the first African-American head of one of the residential colleges at Harvard, was pushed out of that position as head of the residential college because of his defense of as a member of the team defending Harvey Weinstein against horrible charges. But that's what criminal defense lawyers do, right? So there is this, you no matter how much you have accomplished, no matter how unquestionable your overall principles are, no matter how long your track record is, it seems that there is this zero tolerance for doing anything, any single thing that is seen as being somehow inconsistent with the current prevailing mores. And if I can say something, Larry.
Just briefly. Yeah, please.
What's really odd about that is we have this prevailing movement, again, which I think is wonderful, toward so-called restorative justice, to move away from the overly harsh criminal penalties that we've been imposing in this society and the mass incarceration. And we have people across the ideological spectrum, but certainly liberals and those on the left, wanting to say that even a convicted mass murderer should be offered the opportunity for redemption.
Okay.
And yet there is exactly the opposite, overly punitive, unforgiving attitude toward even people with the most established track records of being committed to social and racial justice.
We're talking with Nadine Strossen, former president of the American Civil Liberties Union and author of Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. Again, we reached out to a number of critics of this Harper's letter, which takes on the issue of so-called cancel culture and what the letter describes as a shutting down of debate with people losing their jobs as a result of coming up with arguments that are believed to be or argued to be insensitive. All of those that we've reached out to were not available to join us. We also reached out to, I think there were two or three of the signatories who revoked their support of the letter. They were not available to join us at this point. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. JJ kind of elaborates. I was trying to to explain the critique about the platform of the people signing the letter, and says the critique is that they have a large platform. They should be prepared to handle online criticism. That's what they're complaining about, Twitter comments. But JJ, I don't think in the letter, I don't think it's about being criticized on Twitter. I think it's about people giving up their jobs after they said things or wrote things that weren't considered to be socially acceptable. We'll continue on Air Talk in just 1 minute. We're talking about a letter published in Harper's yesterday, the liberal publication, that takes issue with so-called cancel culture, the idea that certain arguments shouldn't be seriously debated for fear that they in some way assist a racist narrative or a narrative that marginalizes individuals. Let me share some listener comments. We're getting quite a few of them. This is from John in San Francisco, who says, cancel culture doesn't give allowance for personal growth on the part of people you disagree with. And we also have Richard from Hancock Park, who says, cancel culture is just another form of censorship you would see in countries like China, not the United States. Of course, the difference there is that's governmental censorship. Here we have the First Amendment, which protects against the government doing this kind of thing. These are our private citizens who are making their complaints. Let's talk with Daniel in West Covina. Daniel, your thoughts about the letter in Harper's?
Well, I sort of disagree with its conclusion, and I think it just shows that you have a group of very privileged individuals that want to say that they're being censored or that it's going too far, but they don't take into account that it's been decades and decades of exploitation and accumulation of resources in terms of access to, like, taking positions. And so I think it's misplaced. And then also what your speaker just said about comparing it to prison reform or criminal justice reform to people losing their jobs or assignments, I don't think it's fully there. And there does have to be consequences when people that you expect to be more in tune with what's going on, like with society and so forth. I think we have the right to expect that they'd be more up to date, you know?
Daniel, do you have any concerns about groupthink coming out of that you don't, because of sort of, if it's described as, well, this is the time that we're in, so this is the conversation that it's acceptable for us to have. Do you worry that you don't get a free flow of ideas then about what is the current thought about something?
Well, yes, of course, but it depends on what the subject is. I mean, if it's police brutality, I think that, I mean, I've seen enough of it in my communities to know it's something real. And then, and yes, we do have to be careful with sort of attacking, I think, people that it's a legitimate misunderstanding and so forth, but we're talking about people losing assignments or jobs and not necessarily putting people behind prison or something like that. And so I could see that it could go too far as well.
Daniel, I really appreciate your call. That's Daniel in West Covina. Nadine Strossen, former president of the American Civil Liberties Union, your thoughts on Daniel's point?
Oh, Daniel made so many interesting and good points. I agree with some. I disagree with others. I don't have enough time to go into detail, but I think the most important disagreement or misunderstanding, for which I will take responsibility, is that the letter should have made clear that those who were signing it, we don't feel disabled from speaking. To the contrary, we signed this letter, which has proven to be extremely controversial. Speaking for myself, I was signing it on behalf of my students and other people who don't have the privileged platform that I have as a tenured professor of constitutional law. And surveys have shown, just sticking with students because I'm most familiar with them, surveys constantly show that students are constantly engaging in self-censorship. They fear to discuss openly or even ask questions about the very most urgent questions in our society, such as the example of police reform that Daniel cited. And I'm sure that other signers were also concerned, not about the heads of publishing companies, but about the people who are lower down in the pecking order who don't have as much job security and yet are also being felt that they have to toe the party line, so to speak, or avoid talking on the subject at all in order to avoid losing their job. And of course, being deprived of liberty and imprisoned is the worst oppression, one of the worst kinds of oppression imaginable. But if you can't continue to earn a living, or if you can't continue to pursue your education, those are enormous adverse consequences, and we should be very much more forgiving and much more attempt to reach out in an educative vein before we launch into such a punitive response.
Nadine, one of the critiques that seems to me to undergird much of this, and I apologize if I'm not expressing this accurately, but this is my perception, is we're in a time right now where voices that have been on the sidelines are being heard and being taken seriously and are seeing a variety of different changes in debates on policing, on affirmative action in public education, a wide range of different topics. And that when people who are in positions of authority or have a particularly loud megaphone are able to argue back against that in this moment, that it takes kind of that shaky that shaky ability that is emerging for people who've been marginalized to speak and makes it more difficult for them. And that this is a time to really listen intently to those who have not had a voice. Your response to that, and again, feel free to criticize if you think I'm mischaracterizing. But
I couldn't agree more with that. It is critically important that everybody be free and encouraged to enter this debate, in particular those whose voices have traditionally been marginalized and excluded. But it's not going to be helpful to the perspectives that they are advocating if the listening is only one way. Absolutely. In fact, I would say, Larry, that the essence of respectful listening is not just repeating back what the person has said, not just echoing it, but paying them the respect of engaging with their ideas. Now, to one of Daniel's points and your follow-up, I think that the disagreements and the questions are not over what the problems are, not over the general nature of reforms that we are should implement, but on how, what is the most effective strategy for overcoming these problems and for advancing equality and dignity and inclusivity and diversity. So there's not a, and I think if that's accepted, that we all, most of us, share the same fundamental goals, but it really behooves us to have a vigorous debate about what are the most appropriate and effective and evidence-based and time-tested strategies. And yes, okay, we should all respectfully listen to each other and listen to each other's responses.
Let me share a comment here from Alex in Los Feliz, who writes on the page, "I agree in free speech and debate, but I honestly feel including J.K. Rowling in this letter ruins the whole thing. We should foster debate, but I think the public has the right to stop listening to or stop financially supporting people who continuously post transphobic, racist, or sexist comments." That's how Alex describes J.K. Rowling's comments. I think, Alex, that I didn't read the letter as saying you should continue to financially support or keep listening necessarily. This is, I think, about whether the person loses their platform. So I guess Alex's argument would be that J.K. Rowling, for example, because of her comments about trans people, that maybe your book shouldn't be published or that she shouldn't have some sort of a, you know, a public platform. Nadine Strossen, quick comment, and then I need to break.
A comment is that we should judge the letter by the contents of the letter, not using some kind of litmus test to have, has everybody or anybody who signed it ever said something that's offensive?
All right. Nadine Strossen, thank you so much. I think I kept you on longer than we had scheduled, and I apologize if I ruined your schedule today, but thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Larry. I look forward to the next time.
Thank you. Nadine Strossen, president of the American Civil Liberties Union from 1991 to 2008, joining us. Alex in San Pedro, we talked about this a little bit earlier, said a lot of the criticism falls on the fact the signatories to the letter were prominent individuals. I think there's hypocrisy. But Alex, I think what Nadine Strossen was saying, that's why they signed it, because they felt they were safe to do it. To call this out for concerns about people whose jobs wouldn't necessarily be safe. And Eduardo in Santa Monica says, we had an example right now of how cancel culture operates. Daniel calls in, criticizes the former head of the ACLU, and uses her privilege as a truncheon. He basically said, you're privileged, therefore you can't speak. That's Eduardo in Santa Monica. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, I'd like to hear from you if you have been in a months or years long dilemma over how to help a family member who is dealing with a mental health crisis or serious mental illness. This comes to the fore in the case of Dodger outfielder Andrew Tolles, who has had, according to his family members, over the past year plus, a series of very serious mental health episodes that have caused them concern for his safety, and they've tried multiple ways to intervene to help him. I'd like to hear from you if that is in part your story. 866-893-KPCC, back in 90 seconds.